welcome to the March edition of our Pensions Podcast. And this podcast series sees us bring you the most recent pension law developments in a practical way. This month's podcast will be brought to you by me, Philip Goodchild, a partner in the pensions team, and Alex Bellis, who's an associate in the team.
Thanks, Philip. I understand it has been another busy month, not least of all because we've had the Chancellor's budget this month. So was there anything in there that you found surprising from a pensions perspective?
I don't think there was anything particularly surprising contained in the budget, Alex. The pension announcements built upon the government's continued emphasis on encouraging the investment of pension fund assets into UK productive finance, value for money, and improving returns for savers and consolidation.
Yes, and I saw there'd been some controversy in the press regarding proposed disclosure requirements for defined contribution schemes.
Yes, indeed. One of the announcements in the budget was that the government will bring forward requirements for defined contribution pension schemes to publicly disclose their asset allocation. This will include the allocation of investments in UK equities. The Chancellor's announcement on the 2nd of March on further pension reform suggested that this would be achieved by 2027. The FCA is going to consult on requirements in the spring, and the government is also looking to introduce equivalent requirements for the local government pension scheme from April 2024. If these measures do not result in an increase in allocations of UK equities in pension scheme investments, then the government has said it will take further action.
Were there any other pensions announcements?
Yes, just to mention, the government also announced that the FCA and pensions regulator will be given additional regulatory powers to close schemes to new employers and even wind up schemes which are consistently offering poor value for money. In addition, the budget also confirmed that the government remains committed to looking at a lifetime provider model for defined contribution schemes in the longer term. Along the same lines, I also noticed that the government has published another consultation looking into how defined benefit pension schemes can be used to improve investment in the UK economy. I understand one way of doing this is to look into making it easier for employers to extract surplus in those types of schemes. Alex, could you maybe have an explanation as to how that might work?
Of course. Thanks, Philip. So you might recall that last year the government decided to make it more attractive for employers to extract surplus from defined benefit pension schemes by committing to reduce the rate of tax payments by employers on a refund of surplus from 35% to 25%. And that's coming into force April this year. The hope is that if employers and members can share in the strong investment returns, it may promote investment in productive assets. The most recent consultation builds upon this premise by proposing two additional changes. So the first would be a statutory override, which would ensure all schemes can extract surplus where certain funding levels are reached. And the second would be to simplify the process for trustees making one-off payments to members.
Well, that's interesting, Alex. Is there not a concern that promoting surplus extraction could put member benefits at risk?
Well, as you say, Philip, but the government is very aware of this and emphasises in the consultation that they are keen to ensure that surplus extraction will not put member benefits at risk. As a result, they are proposing that schemes would need to be fully funded on the low dependency funding basis, plus either a fixed margin. So, for example, this could be 105% funded on a low dependency basis, or a variable margin, which would be based on the investment risk in order to extract that surplus. A further option is that in return for a higher PPF levy, the PPF would provide 100% compensation for the scheme.
Wow, that's really interesting. I understand that the consultation also builds upon the government's continued emphasis on consolidation.
Yes, that's right, Philip. So the government also intends to establish a public sector consolidator, which would be administered by the PPF, and it has plans to do so at some time by 2026.
Which schemes will this be aimed at?
So initially, there won't be specific eligibility criteria, but the consolidator will be particularly aimed at schemes who are smaller and therefore maybe less well funded and not on track for buyout or attractive to commercial consolidators. The expectation would be for the consolidator to invest part of its fund in high growth UK assets.
It sounds like there may be some new end games for both well-funded and smaller, less well-funded schemes as a result of this. We might therefore see some well-funded schemes moving away from buyout and instead just being run off and utilised as investment vehicles in the meantime. Smaller schemes may look to some extent at public sector consolidation. Moving on, this month has also been busy with respect to developments around the abolition of the lifetime allowance. We have seen regular updates from HMRC in this area around how this will work in practice. This has culminated in the Finance Act 2024 receiving royal assent, and HMRC have also published regulations amending certain aspects of the Finance Act 2024, in particular regarding the pension's commencement excess lump sum.
So this is a relatively recent development, Philip. So how will the pension's commencement excess lump sum now operate in practice?
Good question, Alex. As initially drafted in the Finance Act 2024, a pension commencement excess lump sum could only be taken once a member had used up all of their lump sum allowance, the standard amount of which is £268,275. The regulations, however, will change this to allow a member to take it if a member has used up either their lump sum allowance or their lump sum and death benefit allowance, the standard amount of which is £1,073,100.
So what's the significance of this change then?
Another very good question, Alex. Well, this change would allow, for example, a member who has taken a serious ill health lump sum benefit, who has exhausted their lump sum and death benefit allowance, but not a pension commencement lump sum, and therefore their lump sum allowance remains intact, to take a pension commencement excess lump sum. The Finance Act 2024 also provided that a pension commencement excess lump sum could only be paid up to the permitted maximum amount. Again, amending regulations have removed this concept of a permitted maximum.
I see. So does this mean that there's now no longer a limit to the amount that can be taken as a pension commencement excess lump sum?
This does appear to be the implication, Alex. But members can only take such a sum if the conditions in the legislation are satisfied. In addition, schemes do not have to allow members to take pension commencement excess lump sum. However, the Finance Act 2024 contains a provision which will incorporate a pension commencement excess lump sum payment into the rules of the scheme, which currently permits lifetime allowance excess lump sums. We are on hand to assist clients, of course, with any questions or advice they need on these developments and the implications that they may have on their schemes.
Well, thanks for that, Philip. Shall we move on to our final topic, where we will consider a slightly unusual Pensions Ombudsman decision of Mrs. E. So this case is a rare instance of statutory regulations being successfully overridden by the equitable remedy of estoppel by representation. In this case, the claimant was a cohabitee of a deceased member of the local government pension scheme. The Local Government Pension Scheme Regulations 1997 provided that a survivor's pension would be payable after the death of a member to their spouse. They also provided that this pension would be provided to a cohabiting partner, but only if the member was still active after April 2008. So in this case, the member, having received a terminal diagnosis, called the pension service provider to confirm whether the pension would be payable after his death to his partner, whom he had not married. He was told that a pension would be payable to her, and specifically that it would be payable in spite of the fact that he was not married to her. After his death, his partner attempted to claim the pension and she was informed that she was not eligible for the pension, so the member had left active service before 2008. The couple, crucially, had also taken out a loan in reliance of the fact that the survivor's pension would come into payment to the claimant after the member's death. So in the absence of the survivor's pension, the claimant claimed she'd suffered financial hardship as she has had to cover outgoings with her limited savings instead.
Goodness me, that's a difficult case. Isn't it the case, however, that trustees must provide the pension a member is entitled to under the rules of the scheme, regardless of contrary information that they may have been provided?
Well, yes, that's correct, Philip. That's definitely the general principle, and this case is definitely an exception to that. So the Ombudsman noted that the member had been misled to an extent that constituted maladministration. However, it did state that the relevant regulations had to be followed, which meant that no survivor's pension would have been payable. Yet, unusually, the Ombudsman held that an estoppel by representation defence could be applied in this case, that the very high threshold to do so was met. So the member had been given a clear and unambiguous representation that the survivor's pension would be payable to the claimant, giving them a reasonable expectation that the survivor's pension would actually be paid out. It was also reasonably foreseeable that the member would rely upon this, and the member acted on the incorrect information to the claimant's detriment by taking out the loan. The Ombudsman therefore directed that sums equal to the survivor's pension should be paid to the claimant as though she were actually entitled to it, with interest applied to pensions arrears. There was also a distress and inconvenience award of £2,000 made for the severe distress the maladministration caused.
Goodness me, as you say, that is an unusual outcome, but clearly there's some particular circumstances here which prompted the Ombudsman to favour the estoppel by representation defence. Important for everybody to note that amongst our clients. Well, thanks, Alex. That's it for this podcast. Thanks very much for joining us. We discuss these topics in more detail in our March snapshot and our briefings at the www.pensionshub.com if you would like some further information. And of course, our Stevenson Harwood Pensions team is always on hand to assist you. You can listen to this podcast again and subscribe to the series on iTunes or Spotify or on our Pensions Hub. Please do join us again in April for the next instalment, and thanks for listening.